welcome to the people who are just dropping in. You're quite welcome to do that throughout the weekend, tomorrow also. Each of these classes will try to make self-contained and summarize what we've done already and then move forward. This is, as I mentioned to the people who were here earlier this afternoon, the first of a series of courses that I'll be teaching over the course of the next several years, if I live long enough, which will form the curriculum for what we're calling the Middle Way Centers, in one of which is in Melbourne, and others are in the U.S. and Singapore and Canada. And this one is the foundational course. This one's the one on which we build everything else, the structure, the edifice. This particular course is centered around four concepts. One is we got a problem. We got a problem here. Houston, we have a problem. Like we said earlier, Houston, like those astronauts said when their spaceship didn't work. Houston, we have a problem. And of course, if you don't think that there's any problem in life, if you don't think that, you know, that just working all day and buying and watching television and going on holidays and getting old and dying, there's nothing wrong with a kind of a life like that, well, then there'll be no interest in the spiritual life. There'll be no interest in change. So the recognition of the problem is critical if there's going to be any movement towards, you know, any kind of solution, any kind of correction. And many, many people just, go through their whole lives not really realizing that there's a problem, of course, until there are problems. And none of us escape problems in life. But we're all kind of taken by surprise when they happen. You know, how could this have happened? I just lost my loved one, or I just lost my job, or I just lost my health, or I just lost my youth. How could this happen to me? And, you know, so it's kind of important to be aware of the facts of life. These are the facts of life. And so last class we were talking about one kind of articulation of the facts of life. That we don't get what we want. Has that ever happened to you? That you don't get what you want, we do get what we don't want, and we lose what we'd like to keep. And that kind of sums it up. That's the first of what you know we've been calling here the worthy truths. The first worthy truth, noble truth, worthy truth, whatever you want to call it. First thing the Buddha said was that, you know, you all got problems. After he got awakened, he said, like, you know, I remember what it was like. He's kind of like, you know, he's kind of like looking back. He's kind of like, he's escaped the goldfish bowls and he's looking back into the goldfish in the water. We're swimming in the water. So sometimes we don't recognize it, you know. We're swimming in the water of difficulty, of problems, of stress, of anxiety. And unless it really is slapping us upside the head, which it does, unless it's really conking us upside, you know, on the top of the head, we sometimes don't even recognize the difficulties. We don't even recognize how unhappy we are. Because it's just the water that we swim in, the air that we breathe. We got used to it. We got accustomed to it. Over the course of many, many years of disappointment, of stress, of anxiety, of things not working out, we just got kind of used to it. And so unless the trauma is rather serious, which it can be and will be for all of us, we'll have serious blows, you know, in our lives. But unless that happens, you know, oftentimes we just kind of like sleepwalk through life, going, well, you know, as long as it's not serious suffering, I guess I'll just, like, you know, sort of muscle through and try to ignore it. Try to settle for it. Is good enough, or, you know, at least it's not terrible, and just ignore the fact that we're pretty unhappy pretty much all the time. You know? Because of dissatisfaction. We're not satisfied. Mick Jagger was right. Can't get no. Anyone not know that song? This is the world's most played song, I think. I can't get no satisfaction. And we try, but we just can't get no. Every time we get what we think we want, we start wanting something else. And every time that we don't get what we want, we're disappointed. Over and over and over. And every time we lose what we'd like to keep, we go, how could this have happened to me? This is so unexpected. So part of the solution, you know, this is the problem. This is number one, it's the problem. Part of the solution is recognizing what the problem is. You see? You can't have a solution unless you know what the solution is the problem for. Wait a second. That didn't come out at all, right? But you know what I mean. You can't find the solution unless you know what the problem is that the solution is for. That came up, right?
Yeah.
I think that right. That's right. So the problem, in sum, I mean, there's all kinds of ways of thinking about the problem. The problem is, you know, we have disasters in life. We have things that we didn't want to have happen. We don't get the kinds of things that we want. You know, have you noticed that most of us are over the age of about six? Everyone here is over the age of about six, and if you haven't, like, noticed that, you know, things just don't work out always for you in life, then you just, like, totally haven't been paying attention. Totally haven't been paying attention. So there's all kinds of ways of talking about the first worthy truth, which is that there's stress in life. There's unhappiness in life. And it kind of is, it permeates us all. Pretty much all the time. You know, for the people who are here in the earlier afternoon session, we did a little thought experiment, a little check, and you can do this at any time, day or night, and just check and just stop and say, what's wrong? What's wrong? And there's always something. Physically, there's always something wrong. When it's not a big thing, it's a little thing physically. Always. Always. And let alone mentally. We're always just sort of dissatisfied. When we're not really unhappy and dissatisfied, we've got low-level versions of it. We're just not happy with our lives as they are unfolding on a moment-to-moment basis. We are very infrequent visitors to the present here and now. We love to escape it all the time. And part of that is thinking that no matter how good here and now is, there must be something better then and there. You know, later, it'll be better. So that's a form of dissatisfaction too, of never sort of being content with here and now. And always wanting it to be. Sometimes we got the reverse problem, which is like nostalgia. Which, you know, thinking, well, it used to be good. You know, this is the good old days syndrome. The older you get, the more you're susceptible to the good old days syndrome. Memory plays all kinds of tricks on you. This is all, you know, the music was so much better in the 1960s. It's just noise now. There were a few good bands in the 1960s, but there was really a lot of bad music in the 1960s. And we just, like, forget that. We filter it all out, and we have this sort of romanticized, you know, kind of gauze, you know, looking through gauze at the past, thinking, oh, it was sometimes. Oh, it was so much better back then. So either it's we're doing some kind of hallucination backwards or some hallucination forwards, thinking, oh, in the future it'll be better. I wish I were in the future. I wish I weren't here and now. Here and now. So discontent. That's the problem. You could sum it up as saying the problem is that we're discontented. Okay? All the time. Pretty much all the time. The second worthy truth, and, you know, as I suggested earlier to the people who are here, these are universal, okay? This isn't the province, the product, or no one tradition owns this kind of understanding. Every authentic spiritual tradition assumes that there's a problem. In a non-spiritual life, right? Assumes that there's a problem. And then the second one, and this is, again, I think, universal, that there is a cause to the problem. Because if there wasn't a cause to the problem, we would all be very much screwed, to use technical language. Because if there wasn't a cause to it, we couldn't stop the cause to it. You see what I mean? If there wasn't a cause to it, it would be hardwired. It would be permanent. Caused things are changing things. That's a kind of a truism in Indian logic. Caused things are changing things. Uncaused things are changeless. Uncaused things are changeless. So, fortunately, our difficulties, our stress, our problems, our anxiety, our unhappiness, our discontent is caused. Now, the next question is, and this is today's class, but I'll summarize all four of them and come back. And it's not somebody else who caused it. That's kind of critical. Oftentimes, you know, we're either sort of want to say, you know, things just happen for no reason. Bad things, difficult things, problematic things, bad luck, we say. Bad, you were in the wrong place at the wrong time or something like that. Bad luck. Or, if we don't say that, it's somebody else's fault. Somebody else made me unhappy. And if somebody else has the power to make you unhappy or to make you happy, either one, there's nothing you can do about it. Actually, you can beg them, maybe, please make me happy, or beg them, please make me unhappy, but it's not in your power. If you've given another person the power to make you happy or to make you unhappy, then you can't do anything about it yourself. And you can't do anything about it if you think that it's just random. If it's not caused, then you also are completely victimized. You see? So today, in this session, we want to talk about the cause, and we want to take power. We want to empower. By taking responsibility ourselves for the cause of our unhappiness, we empower ourselves. And without taking that responsibility, we remain totally disempowered. And that's kind of really important to get clear. You see, it's kind of easy, it's habitually easy to blame other people for our problems. But we don't quite sort of fully recognize the ramifications of doing that. The ramifications of doing that is that you lose power over your own life. You give a power away, actually, that you always have had and always will have. But you don't recognize it because you gave it away. Somebody else can make me happy or unhappy. Either one. Is to give your power away and to disempower yourself. And that's no way to find a solution to the problem. The way to find the solution to the problem is to realize that there is a cause and it's no one else's fault. It's our own problem and our own responsibility. That's the second one. The third worthy truth, which we'll talk about especially tomorrow, first session tomorrow at 12:30. There's an alternative. There's an alternative to the problem. So let's try to remember what the problem was. In sum, what's the problem? Discontentment. Discontentment. Discontentment comes in two forms. I'm unhappy that I don't have something I want. I'm discontent because I don't have something I want. And I'm discontent, that's one form, right? And I'm discontent because I do have something that I wish to get rid of. Those are the two forms of discontent. Yeah? Is there a third one? I think that covers the basics. I'm unhappy because I don't have something I want that if I had it, I'd be happy. I'm discontent because I don't have something I want. And I'm discontent because I do have something that if only I could get rid of, then I'd be happy. Maybe it's your husband or wife, the brother-in-law, the boss at work, you know, right? So those are the two kinds of discontent. So if that's the problem, what's the alternative? What's the goal? Not hard. Not hard, kids. Yeah. Just take the dis away. If the problem is discontentment, then the goal is contentment. Okay? And it's kind of as simple as that. You know, the spiritual life, you can make it as complicated as you want. And most people really prefer to have it very, very complicated. So So we offer, you know, four class courses over the course of a whole weekend, stretch it all out, you know, 2-hour things with like exercise. We'll have a little exercise at the end, and, you know, use big fancy words maybe, but it's, you know, you could also just make it quite simple. And it comes down to that, I think. Quite simply, the goal is to be content. Period. And, you know, some people are just discontent with that as a goal. He said, no, I want more than that. I want angels and, you know, heaven, or I'd like a light body so I could walk through walls, and, you know, I'd like a ESP maybe so I could read people's mind. You know, they're not content with contentment as the goal. So I have students like this. I have advanced students like this who I've been teaching for years and years and years who, you know, it's just like, you know, when they hear contentment, it's just like this, no. That's too simple or simplistic, or, you know, it's not complicated enough, or it's not cool enough, or whatever. So I've come up with a formula. Just try to be content first, and then see if, when you're content, if you could be discontent with contentment. See, it's a win-win situation. Maybe there are angels and unicorns and, you know, beautiful lands with rainbows that you're going to walk around with your rainbow body and your angel body and all like that. Maybe, I don't know, who knows. But I know this, that if you're content, it won't matter either way. If there is or there isn't. If there is more or if there isn't. Because guess what? You'll be content. So just try it. I mean, you got nothing to lose, actually, with contentment. You know, you might think, oh, it's like, well, it's not that big of a deal to be content. Well, just try it then. Should be easy if it's so easy, you know, maybe easier than walking through walls and with a rainbow body and angel wings and flying around, sitting on clouds playing harps. Maybe it's easier to just be content. But try it. It actually isn't that easy. Even for people living amazingly blessed lives like ourselves, it isn't that easy to be content. Let alone for, you know, less fortunate people. So that's the goal. I mean, we'll talk about it more tomorrow, and I'll, you know, we'll probably use Sanskrit words, you know, to talk about to make it more, you know, complicated. Because we're also complicated, sophisticated, and overnights. But comes down to that, really. Simple as that. Just be content. That's the goal. And then the last noble truth is, well, there's a method. There's a method to achieve the goal. And, you know, again, we can make it as difficult or, you know, kind of complex or difficult as we want, but, and we will. We'll try to complexify it quite studiously. To talk about like 8 different possible, you know, parts of the method, plus some more. We'll throw some other stuff in. It's not just 8, okay? We'll make it 12 maybe, or 15. 15 part method or something like that, right? But really, the method can be stated as simply as this. How do you become content? If that's the goal, the problem is discontent. That's number one, right? First truth, first worthy truth. That discontentment is caused by what? What's the cause of discontentment? Not that hard. Being discontent. Discontentment is its own cause, right? Right? Discontentment comes from discontentment. The goal is the dropping the dis. So what are you supposed to method is? Practice contentment. What else? Here's the thing, okay? We'll do it like this. We'll do it like another little thought experiment. What more would you need to be content? Or what less, actually, too, right? What more that you don't have that you would like, and what less of what you do have that you want to get rid of would you need to be content? And if you have an answer to that question, that's why you're not content. If you have an answer to that question. You say, no, well, I need more money, or I'd like better relationships, and I need to get rid of that brother-in-law who's driving me crazy, and then I'd be content. If you have an answer to the question, why aren't you content? That's the reason why you're not content. See, because you have an answer to the question, why aren't you content? It's so simple that it kind of eludes us. It's so like, what kind of shell game? You know shell games where they like move the thing, a little ball or marble or something beneath the shell? What kind of shell game is that? It sounds too easy. Like it's just playing with words or something, but it's actually not. The only way to be content is to just be content. It's not to get something more. See, that's the nature of discontentment, is always wanting something more or less, right? Something more that you don't have or less something that you do have. That's the nature of discontentment. So it kind of all comes down to that. That's the simplest way we could put it. The problem is discontentment. The cause of discontentment is continual discontentment. The goal is contentment. And the method to that is to practice contentment. That's all. So I'll give you a mantra now. The contentment mantra. Many of you have had this mantra, this transmission of these holy words before. Some of you get it for the first time. Say Om. That sounds like a mantra is coming, doesn't it? That sounds like a genuine, you know, spiritual, Eastern spiritual mantra. Om. Say I.
Have
enough.
Ahum.
Ahum sounds like the end of a genuine Sanskrit mantra, which it is. Om is the beginning of a mantra. Ahum is the end of the mantra. I have enough is the contentment part of the mantra. And you can chant that as you're walking up and down the the shopping streets here in Paran. And as you're watching television and as you're being bombarded on the internet by ads and you know, and the radio, and Om, I have enough. I have enough shoes. I have enough clothes. I have enough gadgets. I have enough products, iPhones and iPods and iPads and all the products. I have enough relationships. I don't need to have more. You know, in the old days, they used to have Rolodexes. Remember Rolodexes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where you actually had to, like, use part of your body to find an address. Now you just pull it up on the screen, of course, right? It's the same idea. It's just like collecting, you know, friends like that, or friends on Facebook also, you know, collecting relationships. Okay, we have enough. Have enough relationships. Have enough enough promotions at the job. Have enough money. Have enough. Have enough. Have enough. And so when you believe it, we don't have enough silence. Regan, go stand in the corner.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
You got too many friends, Regan.
Om, I have enough. And when you believe it, then you'll be content. I have enough. And you know, there's kind of a corollary to it. And everything that I have is necessary. Om, I have enough of what I have. Om, I have enough. And everything that I have is necessary. Everything that I have, I accept. And you chant that over and over and over again. Om, I have enough, ahum. Om, I have enough, ahum. And when you believe it, you'll be content. And not until. And not until. That's the nature of contentment. That's the nature of the goal. That's true happiness. That's what it means to be happy, is to be content, to be accepted, to be saying yes to life. Instead of saying, no, no, I don't want this. No, I'm not happy with what I have. I want more. See, the yes saying, the radical yes saying, that's the goal. Total affirmation of life as it is. See, not some life that you'll have later in some fantasy land. This is how it works over and over and over again, right? With discontentment. Is that we always hope, we always like, actually more than hope, we assume that when we get something that we don't have, we'll be finally happy. And we assume that if only we get rid of, you know, something we do have, then we'll be happy. We just assume over and over and over again. And our whole lives are kind of, we're being led around by our own noses. We're leading ourselves around by our own nose over and over and over again, thinking, setting ourselves up over and over and over again. If only I had this, then I'd be happy. Only got that, I'd be happy. Only get rid of this idea. And there's only one thing worse than getting what you want, than not getting what you want. I blew it. There's only one thing. I just pretend I didn't say anything before. There's only one thing worse than not getting what you want. And that's getting it. Because then you go, oh, didn't really want that. This wasn't what I thought would happen when I got this. Okay? So we'll talk about that today in this class. The cause. The cause of our suffering is perpetual discontent. Wanting what we don't have and not wanting what we do have. So you have a handout, right? Everyone get a handout? So this is the second one. Class two, the cause. Nothing happens for no reason, you could say. Nothing happens for no reason. There's a cause to everything. And it's not someone else's fault or responsibility. Okay? This is, again, from the readings that come from a variety of sources. This the first one here is the Dhamma Chakkappavattana Sutta, which is a Pali text, an early Buddhist text, in which the Buddha supposedly first preached? That doesn't sound right. Preached. The first sermon, his first teaching. Now this, O monks, is the worthy truth of how distress arises. So the first worthy truth that we talked about in the earlier class was that life is filled with problems. Life is filled with distress, with stress and distress. So he's talking to other monks. That's why it says O monks. Now this, O monks, is the worthy truth of how distress arises. It is the craving which brings about repeated rebirth accompanied by desire for sensual pleasure. So the key word in that is craving. In Pali, it's called tanha. In Sanskrit, trishna. And it means, always wanting. For the people who were here last night and your people who have heard me talk before, my best favorite analogy, metaphor, for craving is itchiness. We're always itchy. So craving, Krishna Tanha, is always, feeling like if only I scratched. See, itchiness like produces scratching, right? Itchiness means, oh, I need to scratch. I'm not okay the way I am. Itchiness means I'm not okay. And so we perpetually scratch the... We scratch. As soon as we get an itch, we try to scratch it. There are some itches that are more difficult to scratch than others. It's relatively easy to scratch an itch like, I want to go to the new Thai restaurant. For most of us, pretty easy to scratch that itch. And we do. We go to the new Thai... oftentimes we work ourselves up a little bit for these kinds of things. Or the movies, I want to see The Great Gatsby in 3D. I really want to see it. I don't have time to see it, but now the weekend's come. And so we start like working ourselves up. We get the itch and we kind of encourage the itch. Because it's going to feel so good when we scratch it. So we kind of work ourselves up. Oh, The Great Gatsby. So interesting. Australian director. Isn't it? That Bose guy, or what's his name? Bad. Yeah. So we get this, and then we finally, make it to the movies. Not that hard, actually, to, scratch it just like that. So we go, and we put on our 3D glasses, and we sit there for two and a half hours, and, marvel at the filmmaking and the beautiful people and the storyline, and scratching, the whole time. Then what happens? Then we leave the movie theater and we all talk to each other. Oh, it was wonderful. Did you see the costumes? Leonardo DiCaprio is so cute. And we talk about how awesome it was as we were scratching that itch. And then, like in a couple of days, a new itch comes. Oh, I didn't know. Did you see the Great Gatsby? Yeah, I saw the Great Gatsby. Is there anything else to see? So, oh, yeah. And then the itch starts again. Same with the Thai dinners. Oh, I had a new Thai dinner. Thai restaurant just opened up. Gotta go. All the papers are writing about it. The reviews are in. You know, everyone's talking about it. New Thai restaurant. What curry? They got great curry. You know, we get the itch all gets going. And then we go. And we have our, you know, and it could be a very, very good restaurant. You have a wonderful Thai meal. And then what happens? Then we my Thai meal. Oh, it's so good. And then what happens? Get hungry again. You get a little peckish within a couple of hours, actually. You know? Maybe you didn't have a whole lot of leftovers, you know, from the Thai restaurant because you ate it all when you were there because it was so good. You're scratching. There's the one, it's the next one. Oh, I wish I could go to Bali. If only I could go to Bali. See, then we get the itch goes. Oh, I read, look at the beaches in Bali. Oh, is this and that in Bali? Bali. I can hardly wait to go to Bali. Yeah, so you save up your money. These are relatively easy itches to scratch, relatively, for people like us, you know, prosperous people. So you save up some money and you go to Bali and say, Bali, oh, beautiful beaches. And, oh, there's wonderful Indonesian food here and all that. You know? And then after a week or two, it's like, time to go home. It's kind of boring here in Bali, you know? Been there, done that. Check it off the list. And then you wait for the next one. Oh, Fiji, I gotta go to Fiji. Over and over and over again, over and over. So some of those itches are easily scratched. Some of them are a little more difficult. The ones that we've been talking about, you know, kind of outside of, well, off and on, throughout the last 2 days. Who am I? That's an itch that's harder to scratch. The question of identity. Niggling? Who am I? What's the point, you know? These kind of like bigger itches to want to know, like, why? What's the point? Who am I? What am I supposed to be doing here? What's the purpose of my life? Those are harder to scratch. So those are the ones that keep us unhappy in a more permanent kind of a way, a more ongoing kind of a way, instead of a recurring kind of a way. They got legs. They got some continuity, you know. The itches to want to have another Thai restaurant experience, that comes and goes and then comes and goes. But these ones are more continuous. Who am I? What's the point of life? What am I supposed to be doing here? What was I put here to do? What's the point? Anyway, so that's the itchiness. The great itchiness of what's called here craving. Craving, wanting, all the time wanting. And so you can think about the goal as the end of itching, itchiness, the end of itchiness. And if you think about it, okay, I promise we talked about this last night, I promise we'd come back to it, and we should. I think we should come back to it over and over again, personally. Behind every itch is the hopes that if I scratch this one, it'll be the last itch. That's why we scratch, actually. We scratch not in the hopes of creating more itch. Of course, that's what happens. But the hope is that if I scratch this one, then I wouldn't be itchy anymore. Right? If I got to the Thai restaurant, the popular new Thai restaurant, then I wouldn't want to go to Thai restaurants anymore all the time. See? If only I got to Bali, then I wouldn't want to be going to Bali places all the time. See, if only I could get the things that I think I want, then I wouldn't be wanting all the time. See, behind every scratch of the itch is the hope that you'll be content. That it'll be the last itch. The problem is that there's never going to be a last itch. Okay? There's never going to be a last scratch, let's put it that way. Every time you scratch, it creates a new itch. Even though the hope is, by scratching, I won't have any itch, the reality of it is, every time you scratch, you get a new itch.
You see?
So the cycle has to be broken. The cycle has to stop with the itchiness, not with the scratching. The scratching, we've been trying our whole lives to stop itchiness by scratching. Am I getting lost in the metaphor here? You still follow me here? The metaphor? Yeah. We've all tried our whole lives to be happy, to stop the wanting, the craving, by trying to satisfy it. Instead of getting it at the root, instead of undermining the root, which is the itchiness, not the scratching. The solution is getting at the itchiness. Okay? That's what we'll talk about, I think, tomorrow. The method for achieving a happy life. We're talking about the cause. The cause is perpetual itch. The cause is the craving, which brings about repeated rebirth accompanied by desire for sensual pleasures. Then he talks about three different kinds of desires here. Sensual pleasures here and there. Then the last sentence. This is a very important one. Everyone see where I am? In sum, it is craving for the objects of sensual desire. These are, sensual desire means the things that we see, hear, feel, smell, and touch. Those are the five senses, right? So the Thai restaurant is something that we taste. Did I get taste before? Yeah. So that's a sensual pleasure. When you put the nice pad Thai, into your mouth, it tastes good. It's sensual pleasure. Or when we see, especially in 3D, Leonardo DiCaprio looking so good as the Great Gatsby. You see the Gatsby character?
Yeah.
Yeah. Pleasurable, sights, right? So these are the sense pleasures. Happiness isn't in the sense pleasures. Real happiness isn't sensual. It isn't a matter of the five senses. It's mental. It's not a matter of like I see pleasant things all the time or I hear pleasant things all the time. It's a mental contentment with whatever you see or whatever you hear. Whether it's Leonardo DiCaprio or some ugly dude. Doesn't matter. See, contentment's in the mind, it isn't in the senses. It's not in the five senses. So this is the first kind of craving. That it is craving for the objects of sensual desire, of wanting things we don't have. Wanting the sensual objects that we don't have. And, one of the exercises is going to be for you to think about that. What is it that you think that you don't have that you want that if you did have, you'd be happy? What is it that you think that you don't have that if you did have, you'd be happy? And what is it that you think that you do have that if you didn't have, you'd be happy? So that's the source of discontent. Actually, the source of discontentment isn't in the things, actually. It's not in the things that you don't have that you wish you had, and it's not in the things that you do have that you wish you didn't have. It's in the wishing. It's not in the things. It's in the very fact that I wish I didn't have something I do have, and I wish I did have something I don't have. It's in the wishing, not in the things. Okay? So that's the first one. In sum, it is craving for the objects of sensual desire. Craving for continuation, which sounds kind of like obscure and philosophical or something. What it means is wanting to keep things that we do have that we like. The continuation of, whatever it is. Prosperity, for example. Everyone, we're all living pretty high on the hog here in Australia these days. Have you noticed? Think that'll last forever? You see, but we want that to last forever. It's nice to have prosperity. Nice to have the ability to buy $4 lattes at a whim whenever we feel $4 lattes. That's actually a standard price now, isn't it? You guys, if you haven't been to the U.S. lately, you might want to go there while the dollar, your Aussie dollar is still strong and get Yeah, you get $2 lattes. Half price. We go to the U.S. like once a year, we see all these Aussies at the airport, and they're all carrying like empty suitcases going to the U.S. to stock up on consumer goods. Not kidding. It's all like dirt cheap. You buy all your new clothes and books? Oh my God. You know, you can't buy a book in Australia for less than $25 nowadays, hardly. You know, half price at least in America for the same book. Same thing. So, we want these, we want the pleasant things to continue forever. That's the second kind of craving. First kind of craving, I want something I don't have. Second kind of craving, listed here, continuation, is I want to keep the good thing I got going forever. I don't want to lose what I do have that I enjoy. And we're all, that's a kind of a craving. Third kind of craving is called termination. The craving for termination, which also sounds a little obscure. It just means I want to get rid of the things that I do have that I don't want. That's the three kinds of discontent. That's the cause. The cause of our distress, of our anxiety, of our suffering, of our sadness, is craving. Is wanting, is itchiness. Wanting something that I don't have. Wanting to keep something that I do have that I don't want to lose. And wanting to get rid of something that I do have that I would like to get rid of. See, like that. Three kinds of craving. In the yoga text, for those of you interested, there's an idea that in the inner body, not the anatomical physical body, but a kind of a spiritual body, that there are three main channels, what they call channels, nadis in Sanskrit. Three main channels running up and down the body. This is similar to the meridian system in Chinese medicine. Many cultures have some version of this kind of thing. That energy is running through our body in different kind of like channels. And the three main ones in the yoga tradition are the central channel, which is central, thus the name. The left channel that runs along the left side, and the right channel which runs along the right side. And the whole problem of unhappiness can be explained in terms of this kind of metaphorical system. Through the left side runs an energy called raga. What's raga? Anybody know? Desire. Kama is another word for it in Sanskrit. Raga means I want something I don't have. And the energy running through the right side is called dvesha, which means anger or hatred, aversion. I don't want something I do have. And the whole idea of yoga, this is real yoga, okay? This is the goal of yoga, is to get the energies that are formally running through those two right and left channels into the central channel. So if the energies of wanting something I don't have, raga, and wanting to get rid of something I do have, dvesha, end up in the central channel, what do you suppose you feel? Contentment. Santosha. Santosha is a Sanskrit word for contentment, but they use higher words, they use more fancy words than that. Ananda, bliss, sukha, happiness. But it all comes down to contentment, that's what it is. Because the two forms of discontentment have collapsed into contentment. Okay? So that's the cause of our problems. It's not outside of ourselves, you see. That's kind of crucial. It's kind of crucial to realize that our discontentment in life isn't somebody else's fault. See? Can't hold somebody else responsible for your own discontentment, can you? Of course, we always do. Right? But it's nobody else's cause but your own. Discontentment is nobody else's problem but your own. So there's a cause to suffering. The suffering is the suffering of discontentment, of unhappiness, of always wishing that you had something that you don't have, or get rid of something that you do have, always wishing that you were somewhere else in some other time, never here and now. All kinds of forms. Those I think are the main two forms of discontentment. The wishing that I were not here and now is one main form of discontent. That I were that I were somewhere else, some other place and some other time. Always. You know, pretty much always. Always thinking about where we're going to go next or where we've been, right? Always thinking about the future of the past. And then that's one kind of discontentment. And the other kind of discontentment is the kind I was just talking about. Wanting something you don't have, wanting to get rid of something that you do have. And wanting to keep something that you can't keep. So the discontentment that comes from craving, desire for continuation, what they call continuation, is wanting to keep something that you can't really keep. So that's from the early Buddhist tradition. Let's look at some text from another tradition. This is the Bhagavad Gita, one of the great classics of world literature. The song of the Lord. Gita means song. Bhagavad means Lord. This is a Hindu text. Attachment to the objects of the senses arises in one who is always thinking about them. It's kind of common sense. Like the word they use for always thinking about it is dhyayata. Dhyayata is the same kind of word that brings us the word dhyana, which is the word for meditation. So another way you could possibly translate this is attachment to the objects of the senses. These are the five physical senses, right? The five sensual pleasures. Attachment to the sensual pleasures comes from obsessing about them, meditating on them all the time. You know, we're pretty good meditators, actually, when it comes to objects of our obsession. We can focus very, very one-pointedly. Right? You know, it's not like we don't have the ability to one-pointedly put our mind on things. You don't have to, like, you know, invent that or, you know, get some implant in order to do that. We do it all the time. We obsess about things that we want, and we obsess about things that we hate. Both. Lust and hatred. Those are the highest forms of it, okay? I don't know if any of you many times people who come to things like this don't want to admit it. But if you've ever had a real enemy, someone that you really hate, see, and again, spiritual people don't, no, I have problems with him. I don't hate anyone, but I, you know, she's a little problematic. She's challenging. But, you know, if you're honest with yourself, maybe you've had the experience of really hating someone, of having a real enemy. Guess who you think about almost all the time? It's the opposite kind of obsession as when you first sort of fall in love with someone, or fall in lust also, and you just can't stop thinking about them night and day, one-pointedly, you know, over and over and over again. So it's not that we don't have the ability to think very, very sort of one-pointedly and concentratedly on things, and we do. But here he's talking about the usual form of that. The usual form is that we obsess on the objects of the senses, either positive or negative, you could say. And then in the Gita it says, from attachment to the object of the senses comes desire, kama, and from desire comes aversion or anger, krodha. So this is another way of talking about the same kind of discontentment, right? The discontentment of desire and the discontentment of aversion. The discontentment of not having something that you want and the discontentment of having something that you want to get rid of. So sometimes they call these in the Indian text the three poisons. Ignorance is defined as the root of all problems, actually. In the Yoga Sutra, they call it the kshetra, the field in which all other problems sort of spring, arise, right? Sprout. But the two main crops that come out of ignorance are desire and aversion. Of wanting what I don't have, and wishing to get rid of the things I do have. And that sums up the main causes of our unhappiness. We're ignorant, first and foremost, okay? In the Eastern traditions, ignorance is the main root problem in virtually all the Eastern traditions. it serves the same kind of role that disobedience serves in the Western spiritual traditions. And we're going to actually look at Genesis in just a few minutes here. As, you know, Genesis means origins, right? How come things got bad? How come we got a crappy life here? See, how come we've got problems? Genesis. What's the genesis of it? And as we'll see, you know, you all probably all know the story. Disobedience. God said, go and chill out and have a great time. Just don't do one thing. Just don't do this one thing. Just relax, enjoy yourself. Nobody's got to go to work. No pain, you know. Just swing in the hammocks all day long. You know, drink umbrella drinks that guys will bring you, you know, with white gloves on the beach. Just enjoy your life. Just don't do this one thing. Guess what? Yeah. And then all kinds of problems. That's the origin of the problem, disobedience. In the Eastern traditions, ignorance serves that same kind of fundamental original role. Although there's not like a first version of it, there's not like in the beginning we weren't ignorant and then we got ignorant, we've always been ignorant. Part of the reason why it's like that is because in Eastern traditions, time is regarded as cyclical, not as linear, not as having a beginning, middle, and end. It's secular. So in a circle, where's the beginning? No beginning. Just over and over and over again. That's samsara, by the way. That's what samsara means. The circle, the cycle of over and over and over again suffering. So ignorance serves that kind of way. Ignorance mostly about why we're unhappy. Right? That's kind of a fundamental form of ignorance. I'm ignorant because I think that if only I got something I don't have, and if only I got rid of something I do have, I'd be happy. That's fundamental ignorance. And then from those ignorance comes those two forms of discontentment. Okay, the three poisons. Grasping and attaching. Grasping and attachment. And craving. Okay, so far, right? Craving, grasping, and attachment are some of the, you know, kind of like round up the usual suspects. Some of the usual suspects for the cause of suffering. The one more from the Eastern traditions, and then we'll turn to the Western ones. This is from the Astavraka Gita. This is also a Hindu text of the Vedanta tradition. For those of you who know, Vedanta is a monistic philosophy. All is one. You know that? All is one. That's Vedanta. As long as desire, the seat of the inability to discriminate, is alive, there will be avoidance and attraction. Avoidance and attraction. So this is a very interesting verse. It's sort of defining desire. And here we mean bad desire. So remind me to talk about good desire. If I forget. You're talking about bad desire. The desire that keeps us dissatisfied. Desire. Okay? Right? It defines it as the inability to discriminate. The inability to know what's going to really bring us the happiness that we really do desire. That's the bad part of desire. The bad part of desire isn't necessarily the desire, but the desire for the wrong things. Okay? So that's bad desire. I think you can put it like this. There's bad desire, there's good desire, and there's no desire. And it kind of works in a hierarchy like that spiritually. So bad desire is the inability to discriminate, the inability to realize that buying a new pair of shoes isn't going to be the end all of your life. It isn't going to make you... I did a whole thing in Canada one time. Was it Canada? No, it was in Utah. Salt Lake City, Utah. The first and only time I've been to Salt Lake City, Utah to teach. They never invited me back. Maybe it was because I did this whole long thing about how shoes aren't going to make you happy. You know? No, I mean, statistically, I've heard that the average Western woman has 30 pairs of shoes, owns 30 pairs of shoes. You believe that? Yep. A lot of people go, yep. No worries. And another pair of shoes is going to have exactly the same trajectory that all the other 30 pairs of shoes have. You know, you bring them home. Oh, I got the purple ones now. I got the purple pumps. I have black pumps. I have pink pumps. I have white pumps. Now I got the purple pumps. And, you know, and oh, I just love the, you know, they match my purple outfits. And, you know, and they're so new and they're so gorgeous. And I'm like, you know. And in a couple of weeks, it's like, yeah, but, you know, they pinched my toes a little bit. And, you know, it's not exactly the purple that I should be. Yeah. And in a couple of months, it's just another pair of shoes. You're sitting around, how would I get rid of those shoes? You know, got a whole closet full, right? Over and over and over. So I did this whole thing on shoes. And this lady, she gets up in the middle of the thing and walks out, muttering, shoes will make me happy. And, you know, well, okay. Keep going. Keep trying. You know, if you really believe that shoes will make you happy, you know, good luck to you. I go, well, I got nothing to say, you know. If you believe shoes are going to make you happy, you should probably go somewhere else instead of listening to me. And we're like, many of us are like that. We're just stubbornly clinging to the idea that the things that we think will make us happy will make us happy, even in the face of the evidence to the contrary. Over and over and over again. This is how consumer capitalism actually works. You see? They're constantly rolling out new products, aren't they? You know, constantly rolling out new products with the hype, you know, whether it's stated or implicit, that this will be the last one, really. This is the final evolution of the iPhone. It's the iPhone 5. It's got Siri. Well, iPhone 4S had Siri too, but this is slimmer. This iPhone's slimmer. You know, it's got this feature and that feature. As if this is, you know, like every time, it's the unspoken message is, and you'll never need another iPhone. You buy this one, and honest to God, we're finished with you. You see? Well, and then only 6 months comes along. 6 months, they start it all up again. Oh, the iPhone 5. Well. GPS sucks. You know, we've fixed up the GPS, and now you got to buy an iPhone 6. Do you think there's an iPhone 6 down the road here? Oh, come on. Over and over and over again, we're just like, when are they going to roll out the last consumer product? They say, okay, all that other time, we're just fooling with you every time, you know, bait and switch. You know that term? Put out the bait and then switch it up. Put out the iPhone 5 and then switch it up for the iPhone 6. When are they going to roll out the last one? Never is the answer. And the reason for that is because they know that we have very short memories, actually, when it comes to this kind of thing. We forget over and over and over again. We forget that the purple shoes are going to have the same trajectory as the white ones. We forget that the iPhone 5 is going to have the same trajectory as the iPhone 4. See? You'll like it for a while, then it'll kind of like get old and, you know, maybe break. Nowadays, we get sick of them before they break. Right? It's not like, you know, you actually need a new car most of the time. You know, the car works fine. But there's no, it doesn't talk to me. You know, my car is silent, doesn't have a camera in the back bumper, so, you know, I actually have to go like, oh, you know. And so we get sick of, we get dissatisfied before they even break. Of course, they're going to break eventually, but we get dissatisfied even before that, over and over and over again. So it's, you know, part of the solution is to just wise up about the cause. You see, the cause is the dissatisfaction over and over and over again. And this just doesn't mean, okay, I am not suggesting that you should never buy another pair of shoes. I wish I could tell that lady in Utah that. She didn't give me a chance to explain myself. I'm not suggesting that you never buy another pair of shoes. Not at all. You know, it's fine to buy shoes. It's fine. It's fine to enjoy the prosperity that you have, okay? Most people around the world would die for the prosperity that we have. So it's not like we should like feel guilty about it or, you know, not enjoy it, but not be stupid about it. You see? and not get suckered in over and over and over again in ourselves. You see, we're suckering ourselves of thinking, well, this pair of shoes will finally make me happy. Or if I finally get to see this 3D movie. See, that's you gotta watch your mind about that. See if it's not true in your own mind. That you're setting yourself up over and over and over again. So go buy new shoes, but be smart about it. Say, oh yeah, I'll enjoy these shoes for a couple weeks and then they'll get old. Go to the movies. Oh, you know, I'll enjoy this experience, 3D experience for a couple of hours and then I'll want another one. You know, you'll be smart about it. Go to the Thai restaurant, have a nice Thai dinner, but don't think, oh, after I have this Thai dinner at this Thai restaurant, you know, somehow I'll be happy forever. See, that's this being suckered over and over and over again. So it's not a matter of not enjoying life. Of course, we should try to enjoy life. But we'll enjoy it a lot more if we recognize the impermanence of it. Right? We'll enjoy it a lot more if we haven't set these kinds of goals so high for these things, for the shoes, for the Thai restaurant, for the Bali vacation, over and over again, that we plunge. You know, we go up, but we have to come down. The further up it goes, the further the crash is as it goes down. So this is what they call in the spiritual traditions equanimity. Equanimity is like a funny English word, and it sounds like, oh, it should just be blasé or something. Equanimity doesn't mean not caring or being blasé. It means being level, being you know, wise enough to know to not go too high or get too low. And to just, like, you know, enjoy the ride without the ups and downs. To just be chill. To just be chillaxed, regardless of the vicissitudes of life. Whether things are going really, really well for you or really, really poorly. To just be chill and say, well, that's the way life is. Life is filled with ups and downs. Life's filled with pleasures and pains. There wouldn't be pleasure unless there were pains. How could I have pleasure unless I had pain? You see, if it was pleasurable all the time, it wouldn't be pleasurable. Right? It has to be contrast. Has to be the downs for there to be the ups. And so you just like to chillax. That's real equanimity. It's just, you know, kind of being kind of balanced as life, you know, takes you for a ride up and down. And it will. You notice? It will. All right, so. Yeah. As long as desire, the seat of the inability to discriminate, is alive, there will be avoidance and attraction, which are the root and branch of this cycle of suffering. So that's for the Eastern traditions. That's a summary of the cause. How would you describe it, would you say? The cause? Dissatisfaction. Dissatisfaction in several forms. Wanting, raga, wanting things you don't have. Vesha, just wanting to get rid of, avoidance of the things that you do have. Dissatisfaction. Cause from ignorance. Okay? The three poisons. Ignorance, desire, and dissatisfaction. You forgot to remind me to talk about desire. Bad desire I already talked about. What's good desire? Good desire, the difference between bad desire and good desire is this. Bad desire is desiring things that won't bring you the end of desire. Good desire is desiring the end of desire. And how are you going to reach the end of desire unless you desire it? You got to put that in your pipe and smoke it for a while. Of course, desire is motivation, isn't it? Where would we be without desire? What would impel us? What would motivate us to do anything unless we had desire? But good desire is understanding. Okay, I'll put it a little differently. Good desire is understanding that behind every desire is the same desire, and that's for the end of desire. Should I say that again? I don't think I can. Good desire is the understanding that behind every desire is the same desire, which is the end of desire.
If only I got these shoes, I wouldn't want shoes anymore. If only I could scratch this itch, then maybe I wouldn't have itches anymore. That's what we all want. We all want itchlessness. The great itchless state. That's tomorrow. Tomorrow's first class. The great itchless state. The goal. The goal is nirvana. Peace. Liberation. Liberation from what? Freedom from what? If not itchiness. Freedom from not, from discontentment. Liberation. Moksha, mukti. These are all the same kind of understandings, ultimately. All right, so let's turn to the Bible. Remember the Bible? Because this is the root text on the cause of our unhappiness, of our discontentment, according to the Western traditions. I think that I didn't have a chance to check, so don't quote me on this. But I think that the Islamic tradition has a similar kind of a myth. Probably based on the same material, actually. Islam is a Judeo-Christian tradition also. Islam presents itself as the culmination of the tradition that began in Judaism and then went through Christ and then... So, it's much the same tradition, actually.
And the story is older than the Bible.
The story is probably older than the Bible, too.
Egyptian.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that. So here it is from Genesis. Now the serpent... Who's, he's standing in for the devil here, okay? The snake's got a bad name. The serpent was more crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God say you shall not eat from any tree in the garden?" So remember the setup, right? They're in the Garden of Eden. They're in paradise. In the beginning, everything was perfect. This is like the Western version of it. The Eastern version of it is our ultimate default position is happiness. Ultimate default position is happiness. So that's the Eastern version. The Western version is, in the beginning, everything was hunky-dory. See that? Hunky-dory. Everything was fine. And nobody had to work. There was plenty of food around. I bet you the temperature was perfect. It's 27 degrees year-round or something. It's like sort of like Singapore. Without the humidity. And God told Adam and Eve, enjoy yourself. Wouldn't that be nice to hear from God? To have like a direct communication from God saying, just relax and have fun. This is God speaking. Just relax and have fun. Don't worry. Be happy. Don't worry. If you started singing that song, don't worry, be happy. I mean, it was God. Then you might take it a little more seriously. Right? Just don't worry. Just don't do this one thing. What is that one thing? Just don't eat of the fruit of this one tree. Okay, so that's the setup. So here comes the demon, the serpent. Did God tell you you shall not eat of it from any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. All of them. Like there's probably 100,000 species maybe there. There's mango trees and apricot trees and orange trees. But just that, not one. That one. He says, we may eat of all the trees of the garden, fruit of the garden, of the trees in the garden. But God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that's in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die. So it's just don't do that one thing. Then the serpent said to God, you will not die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. Some desire there. She took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were open, and they knew that they were naked. And they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves. This is the origin of clothing, among other things, in the Genesis myth.
This, I'm sure, this, you know, I'm not a scholar of Hebrew literature or Christian or Jewish, you know, theology. There's probably been I know for sure that forests have been cut down to make books on deciphering, interpreting, you know, a myth like this. But for our purposes, I just wanted to point out that it's about discontentment also. And it's kind of like the worst case. It's kind of worst case scenario because they have nothing to be discontent about in the Garden of Eden. You know? Their lives are perfect. They're even better than ours, which is ours are already damn good. If you don't believe me, just put your mind in it for a second in the position of somebody living on the pavements of, you know, Bombay, Mumbai, and looking at your life. You see, what would they see in your life? You know, they would see people, gods and goddesses, you know, rolling around in some paradisical world. You see, right? So even better than that, according to the myth, were Adam and Eve, and they still were discontent. They wanted the one thing that they couldn't have, and then they became. It's very interesting that you know, there's a lot, probably a million things to say about this myth. But you will be like God. In what sense? Independent, not having to listen to nobody. See, not having to obey somebody else. I'll be like God. I'll just make up my own mind. I'll eat whatever damn fruit I want to eat. Hubris is a form of discontentment too, of not being content with who you are in the great rank of things, in the great chain of being. Discontentment is rife in this story. The cause of our problems is discontent with our lives. And so, you know, kind of just to preview tomorrow, the solution will be a radical acceptance with who we are, with what kind of life we're leading, with the people in our lives, with everything. And that's the only solution there is to discontentment. The only solution there is to discontentment is contentment, of course. So we keep ourselves discontent through our discontentment. And that's the problem. That's the cause of the problem, and the solution will be the opposite. And the goal will be the state that the opposite brings us. Does that sit there? Yeah. So maybe that's a good place to stop, and if there are questions, we can take questions, and then we'll do a little... As I told the people in the earlier afternoon class, I've included a little exercise for us all to do. At the end of each class, so we'll spend a few moments before we all, you know, head off for the new Thai restaurant dinner experience and our 3D movies, to just spend a few moments to think about kind of the stuff we were talking about and do a little exercise. But first, I'd be happy to try to answer any questions if you have any. Yeah, read it.
Non-emotional
sort of assumed that
I'm happy with what I've got, but they're kind of excited about what's, you know, travels and, you know, and lots of things.
Are they drama queens?
some of them are. Some of them are. But I come away feeling a bit bland, uninterested.
Yeah, that's a good question. Now, first of all, it's hard to tell what other people think of you, number one. They might think that you're an awesome, like, steady rock of Gibraltar. Right? I mean, you know, you don't really know that you're how you're appearing to people. The question is really, is contentment a bland state? And that, I think, you know, we've got all kinds of reasons why we shouldn't be content. And that's one of them. I would just be boring. I would just be living a boring life if I were content. Guess what? You're not going to live a boring life ever. Life will make sure that you're not living a boring life. Okay? No, it'll bring you all kinds of like twists and turns and ups and downs and totally unexpected stuff. Okay? You don't have to worry about that. That's life. Okay? The contentment part of it is accepting whatever life gives you. Okay? Not being bland and going, oh whatever. But accepting the challenges that life throws at you, accepting the opportunities and saying yes to life. You know, whatever life throws at you. But with that kind of chillaxed inner state, you know, that relaxed state of mind. But that doesn't mean that you have a boring life at all. Like I said, life kind of makes sure that we're not bored for too long. I found that at least. You know, as soon as you kind of like think that, you know, as soon as you get like a little complacent about, oh, how I got it all wired now. You know, I got a good job and I got a good partner and I got a nice house. And, you know, then something else happens. Right?
Yeah, no.
And you know, we're kind of, you know, mostly trying to kind of get all the balls up in the air at the same time so that it's all going to go right for us, right? I got the job going, but, you know, well, I got to get the relationship up. You know, now I got the relationship and, you know, but I need a little more money and, you know. And we're trying to get all the balls up in the air, juggling all the balls. And, you know, there are always going to be balls that are falling and, you know, it's a mess. It's not a clever juggling trick. The clever juggling trick is to accept whatever, you know, wherever the balls are. You know? Yeah. So contentment, I mean, I think that's a very common fear or a complaint or something like that. A theoretical complaint, actually, because most people are, almost everyone I know is not perfectly content. I don't know anyone, really, I think, who's perfectly content. But there are approximations, and that's great. But the fear is that, you know, well, then I'll just end up like a boring, gray person with no ups and downs, no. And I just don't think you have to worry about that too much, given the way life is. You know?
I think because the three feelings, you know, if you're talking about feelings as liking, disliking, and neutral, then my understanding of the three is that neutral is part of that feeling, so they're also not saying liking, disliking. If it was only liking and disliking, then neutral would be the state, but in the feeling is liking, disliking, and neutral. So I think, as we said in the 12 links, Malcolm was suggesting neutral was non-committal. So being non-committal is also problematic. You know, because it's not the point to say, oh, the Boston bombings, whatever. You know, to be neutral and non-committal about something is also not the state that they're talking about. So it's problematic to ignorantly like and ignorantly dislike, but the solution is not to be neutral, because then, like we were saying in the other teachings, if I put my hand on the hot plate and I don't like it, I won't take it off. So the problem is craving. The problem is not liking and disliking in that way, but it's craving the continuation of the pleasant feeling or the discontinuation of the unpleasant feeling. You know what I mean? Because the reason that neutral is in there is because we think, oh, if liking and disliking is a problem, then I'll just remain neutral about everything. And then you do become, like, dysfunctional, actually. Then your friend comes to you crying and you say, oh, well, whatever, just... You know what I mean? That you think that you're being neutral is, and that's just not a functional life. You know, that's actually, you know, quite mentally retarded, you know, to not react to anything. So I think that the contentment isn't neutrality. Like, contentment doesn't mean complacency. You're still actively involved, mindfully actively involved in life, and you are, you know, it's fine to like and dislike things because that's how you navigate life. But the craving, as Lamaji was saying, the craving is a problem of, like, of craving and grasping is what creates the karma.
Would you say that discontent is like being constantly in winter?
In winter.
If you don't like winter. If you like cold, you find it upbeat.
Everything's cold, everything's icy, it's pretty miserable, dark.
Yeah, nice. You're from Ireland.
Scotland,
even worse. I used to teach in Ireland in the summertime, and it was like it was dark and gloomy and rainy and all like that. As soon as the sun came out one day, everyone would quit work and jump into the water. They appreciated it.
You've never swum in the summertime in Scotland, obviously.
I think the only risk with the indifference one that Cindy was talking about is what I would call insensitivity, where you are in a state where you block whatever you're meant to be sensing or feeling.
Yeah.
You're blocking, you're insensitive, therefore you're indifferent, or that's something else.
Yeah. And that's these are all forms of discontentment also, of being discontent with the challenging things in life, with the pain, with the disappointments, with the other people's problems and sufferings, of saying, no, I don't want to hear about that, or I don't want to feel that, or I don't want to deal with that. That's another form of discontentment, of course. Yeah, discontentment takes many, many forms, actually. Many guises to it. It's the no saying. I think that's kind of the easiest way for me, at least, to sort of sum it up. It's saying no. I don't want that. No, I'm not going to be happy without that. No. And instead of this sort of radical affirmation and acceptance of whatever, whatever happens. Yes, I'll deal with that now. It doesn't mean, yes, that's okay, whatever happens. It's okay that other people suffer. Yes, that's okay, whatever. See, that's the apathy. That's the mistaking contentment for complacency. Contentment means I'm content with the challenges that life throws my way also. I'm content with the opportunities I have to help people, to, live a better life, to help, contentment with whatever life brings you. Instead of saying, no, I didn't want that, or no, I'll take this one and not that one, that's the difference, I think. Yes, sir.
What's the foundation for making choices? So all the time we're faced with a multitude of choices. How do we choose between them?
You mean in life in general? The choices in life in general?
Yeah. You have three career options. You have all whatever. So you have two whatever. And I'm content where I am.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Well, let me see if I can answer your question. See if this is the answer to your question. I'm often asked questions more specific than yours. You're a spiritual teacher, so should I take the job in Perth, or should I stay in Melbourne and ask the boss for a raise?
It's the same question. How do I divide?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. And my answer is, how the hell am I supposed to know? here's what I really say. Where can you help people the most? Where can you help others the most? Is it going to be in the job at Perth, or is it going to be at the job at Melbourne? That's the only spiritual criteria I know to bring to the question. As to the economics of it, or whether it's a good professional move or not, how the hell do I know?
I'm the smartest, but then I'll be discontent if I'm not helping
them. Well, I suppose you can be discontent about anything, but you can be content with the opportunities that you have to help people, and not be discontent that you don't have more opportunities. We all have opportunities to help people all the time. In our daily lives, we don't all have opportunities to be Iron Man 3, to be a superhero, but we always have opportunities all day long to make little changes in the world around us. And we can be content with that. We can be content with the opportunities that we do have. Yeah. I mean, there's a certain kind of like, you know, it's a little bit difficult to talk about this because, you know, there's a certain sense in which discontentment it plays an important role in a spiritual life also. It's a form of motivation. It's a form of, it's a kind of a form of desire like I was talking about before. So I think, you know, there is a place for it in a sense. There's a place for it and there's a time for it, especially in a person's spiritual trajectory. To say, well, I wish I weren't such a selfish person. I'm just content with being, you know, the kind of angry person, selfish person, whatever your problem is. And then that can serve as a motivation to help you feel like you're doing a better job with the opportunities that you have to be in life, you know. Eventually, the goal is to let go of all discontentment, including the discontentment that probably the biggest discontentment that we have is with ourselves. And to let that go too, and to say yes. Yeah. You know, and on the way to that, that's, you know, that may sound like a distant goal, but on the way to that, here's another mantra, okay? Two mantras in the same session, okay? You got, Om, I have enough, Ahom. That's a very powerful mantra, contentment mantra. Say Om.
Om.
I'm
doing
my best. Okay? And that's all you could do. Right? I'm doing my best. You got to kind of do your best to say I'm doing my best. But if you think about it, we're probably all doing our best. Even when our best isn't good enough. That's all we can do. We're doing our best. And that's a kind of a contentment mantra. I'm doing my best.
That's the girl guys one.
Huh?
Girl guys.
Girl guys?
Yeah.
Girl guys.
Girl guys. Oh, yeah, girl guys.
Good, better, best.
Oh, good.
Really?
I do
my
work.
That's good.
How do you know? Do I do? Let's not go into that too much, Kate. No, I'm not joking about the I'm doing my best thing, you know. That's an important kind of a realization, really, that we're all doing our best. And it's not just to help us all feel better about ourselves. It's also a very, very important realization to help us with other people who are also just doing their best. And, you know, and we all make mistakes and we all can't always live up to the ideals that we set for ourselves, but we're all just doing the best, our best. And, yeah, I think it's a pretty powerful mantra. I'll remind me to give you another mantra tomorrow. I don't want to overwhelm you. Two is enough for any one session. Let's spend a few minutes. Chuck, do you have anything in Singapore? Yeah.
Yeah, I had a question. I just wanted to make sure I didn't read too much of the Genesis definition you put in, but you made it sound, that last line made it sound like prior to desire, there was no self. Because it came so aware of their beauty. Now, were you trying to say that as well? Did you say that? I missed it, or I'm just double checking.
I didn't say that, but I could have said it. Thanks for saying it. Yeah, I mean, of course, they come to the point of shame, right? They were naked. They knew that they were naked, and they were ashamed. So they became discontent with their own state of being, with their own natural state of being. But yeah, you could say in a way that's tied up with a certain kind of self-consciousness. With the self-consciousness that... Okay, now we'll really go for it, okay? I don't know if any of this is actually legitimized by any Christian or Jewish theologian. But maybe that's kind of what it means to be godlike. Is to be self-conscious. Okay? But But we're a kind of a perverted, bastardized version of that. And so instead of being happy with our self-consciousness, we're unhappy with our self-consciousness. I kind of just made that up. I mean, it's very interesting to say you will become like God. If you have your eyes open, which also results in this kind of like realization that, you know, that they're naked and that's not good somehow, that they should be clothed and all like that. That's a kind of self-consciousness, I guess. They become a kind of self-aware instead of just unself-consciously enjoying life and living in the garden. They become aware. And that's a disaster. In a way, that's our problem. We're self-aware, too self-aware. You know, there's good self-aware and bad self. You know what I mean? But that kind of over self-consciousness. It was Dostoevsky. Dostoevsky said, "Being overly self-conscious is a great disease. It's a very terrible disease." You know? Who was it that said the unanalyzed life is not worth living? And then somebody else came along and said, yeah, but the overly analyzed life isn't worth living either. Right? So, you know, we start by analyzing. We start by being self-aware. We start by thinking, well, what is the problem? What is the cause of the problem? Is there an alternative? Is there a solution to the problem? That's a certain awareness, certain kind of self-consciousness, awareness. But I think that we end with the realization that the problem that we become self-conscious of is self-consciousness. I mean, you know, that's one of them. That's one way of putting it. So there are all kinds of problems. You know, we have guilt. We have, you know, we do bad things. We have things that we regret. There are all kinds of problems. But the self-consciousness, the self-consciousness is part of the larger selfishness that is the root of all our problems. Right? Selfishness. All right, please spend a few moments here looking at the exercise and just take a few moments to maybe write down a few things that might be helpful to think about. Think about the place of craving and desiring in your own life. Craving and desire. What do you think you don't have already that if you had it would make you happy? What don't you have that you think if you had would make you happy? And what do you think you have now that if you could get rid of, that you got rid of, it would bring more happiness into your life? What do you have now that if only you didn't have, you'd feel like you'd be more happy? So in other words, you're trying to identify the sources of discontentment in your life.